years ago? 2 years ago, Nurse Tamura said as she checked the list of visitors with a ballpoint pen in hand.
You mean to say that you have not made a single visit in 2 years?
That's right, Tengo said.
According to our records, you are Mr. Kawana's only relative.
That is correct. She set the list on the desk and glanced at Tengo, but she said nothing. Her eyes were not blaming Tengo, just checking the facts. Apparently, Tengo's case was not exceptional.
At the moment, your father is in group rehabilitation. That will end in half an hour. You can see him then.
How is he doing?
Physically, he's healthy. He has no special problems. It's in the other area that he has his ups and downs, she said, touching her temple with an index finger. I'll leave it to you to see what I mean about ups and downs.
Tengo thanked her and went to pass the time in the lounge by the entrance, sitting on a sofa that smelled like an earlier era and reading more of his book. A breeze passed through now and then, carrying the scent of the sea and the cooling sound of the pine windbreak outside. Cicadas clung to the branches of the trees, screeching their hearts out. Summer was now at its height, but the cicadas seemed to know that it would not last long. Eventually, bespectacled Nurse Tamura came to tell Tengo that he could see his father now that the rehabilitation session was over.
I'll show you to his room, she said.
Tengo got up from the sofa and, passing by a large mirror on the wall, realized for the first time what a sloppy outfit he was wearing. A Jeff Beck Japan Tour t-shirt under a faded dungaree shirt with mismatched buttons, chinos with specks of pizza sauce near one knee, long unwashed khaki-colored sneakers, a baseball cap. No way for a 30-year-old son to dress on his first hospital visit to his father in 2 years. Nor did he have anything with him that might serve as a gift on such an occasion. He had a paperback book shoved into one pocket, nothing more. No wonder the nurse had given him that look of disgust. As they crossed the sanatorium grounds toward the wing in which his father's room was located, the nurse gave him a general description of the place. There were three wings divided according to the severity of the patient's illness. Tengo's father was now housed in the moderate wing. People usually started in the mild wing, moved to moderate, and then to severe. As with a door that opens in only one direction, backward movement was not an option. There was nowhere to go beyond the severe wing, other than the crematorium. The nurse did not add that remark, of course, but her meaning was clear. His father was in a double room, but his roommate was out attending some kind of class. The sanatorium offered several rehabilitation classes, ceramics, or gardening, or exercise. Though all were supposedly for rehabilitation, they did not aim at recovery. Their purpose, rather, was to slow the advance of the disease as much as possible, or just to kill time. Tengo's father was seated in a chair by the open window, looking out, hands on his knees. A nearby table held a potted plant. Its flowers had several delicate yellow petals. The floor was made of some soft material to prevent injury in case of a fall. There were two plain wood-frame beds, two writing desks, and two dressers. Next to each desk was a small bookcase, and the window curtains had yellowed from years of exposure to sunlight. Tengo did not realize at first that the old man seated by the window was his own father. He had become a size smaller, though shriveled up might be more accurate. His hair was shorter and as white as a frost-covered lawn. His cheeks were sunken, which may have been why the hollows of his eyes looked much larger than they had before. Three deep creases marked his forehead. The shape of his head seemed more deformed than it had, probably because his shorter hair made it more obvious. His eyebrows were extremely long and thick, and white hair poked out from both ears. His large, pointed ears were now larger than ever and looked like bat wings. Only the shape of the nose was the same, round and pudgy, in marked contrast to the ears, and it wore a reddish-black tinge. His lips drooped at both ends, seemingly ready to drool at any moment. His mouth was slightly open, revealing uneven teeth. Sitting so still at the window, his father reminded Tengo of one of Van Gogh's last self-portraits. Although Tengo entered the room, the man did nothing but glance momentarily in his direction, after which he continued to stare outside. From a distance, he looked less like a human being than some kind of creature resembling a rat or a squirrel, a creature that might not be terribly clean, but that possessed all the cunning it needed. It was, however, without a doubt, Tengo's father, or rather the wreckage of Tengo's father. The two intervening years had taken much from him physically, the way a merciless tax collector strips a poor family's house of all its possessions. The father that Tengo remembered was a tough, hard-working man. Introspection and imagination may have been foreign qualities to him, but he had his own moral code and a simple but strong sense of purpose. He was a stoic individual. Tengo never once heard him whine or make excuses for himself. But the man Tengo saw before him now was a mere empty shell, a vacant house deprived of all warmth. "Mr. Kawana," the nurse said to Tengo's father in a crisp, clear tone of voice she must have been trained to use when addressing patients. "Mr. Kawana, look who's here. It's your son." His father turned once more in Tengo's direction. His expressionless eyes made Tengo think of two empty swallows' nests hanging from the eaves. "Hello," Tengo said. "Mr. Kawana, your son is here from Tokyo," the nurse said. His father said nothing. Instead, he looked straight at Tengo as if he were reading a bulletin written in a foreign language. "Dinner starts at 6:30," the nurse said to Tengo. "Please feel free to stay until then." Tengo hesitated for a moment after the nurse was gone, and then approached his father, sitting down in the chair that faced his, a faded, cloth-covered chair, its wooden parts scarred from long use. His father's eyes followed his movements. "How are you?" Tengo asked. "Fine, thank you," his father said formally. Tengo did not know what to say after that. Toying with the third button of his dungaree shirt, he turned his gaze toward the pine trees outside, and then back again to his father. "You have come from Tokyo, is it?" his father asked, apparently unable to remember Tengo. "Yes, from Tokyo." "You must have come by express train." "That's right," Tengo said. "As far as Tateyama. There I transferred to a local for the trip here to Chikura." "You've come to swim?" his father asked. "I'm Tengo. Tengo Kawana, your son." "Where do you live in Tokyo?" his father asked.
"In Koenji, Suginami Ward."
The three wrinkles across his father's forehead deepened. "A lot of people tell lies because they don't want to pay their NHK subscription fee." "Father," Tengo called out to him. This was the first time he had spoken the word in a very long time. "I'm Tengo, your son."
"I don't have a son," his father declared.
"You don't have a son," Tengo repeated mechanically. His father nodded. "So what am I?" Tengo asked.
"You're nothing," his father said, with two short shakes of the head.
Tengo caught his breath. He could find no words, nor did his father have any more to say. Each sat in silence, searching through his tangled thoughts. Only the cicadas sang without confusion, screeching at top volume.
"He may be speaking the truth," Tengo felt. "His memory may have been destroyed, and his mind might be sunk in mud, but the words on his lips are probably true."
Tengo understood this intuitively.
"What are you talking about?" Tengo asked. "You are nothing," his father repeated the words, his voice devoid of emotion. "You were nothing, you are nothing, and you will be nothing."
"That's enough," Tengo thought. He wanted to get up out of his chair, walk to the station, and go back to Tokyo. He had heard what he needed to hear. But he could not stand up. He was like the young man who traveled to the town of cats. He had curiosity. He wanted to know what lay behind those words. He wanted a clearer answer. There was danger lurking there, of course, but if he let this opportunity escape, he would lose any chance to learn the secret about himself forever. It would sink into total chaos. Tengo arranged and rearranged words in his head until, at last, he was ready to speak them. This was the question he had come close to asking since childhood, but could never quite manage to utter.
"What you're saying, then, is that you are not my biological father, correct? You are telling me that there is no blood connection between us, is that it?"
His father looked at him without speaking. It was impossible to tell from his expression whether he had understood the meaning of Tengo's question.
"Stealing radio waves is an unlawful act," his father said, looking into Tengo's eyes. "It's no different from stealing money or valuables, don't you think?"
"You're probably right," Tengo decided to agree for now. His father nodded several times with apparent satisfaction.
"Radio waves don't come falling out of the sky for free like rain or snow," his father said.
With his lips closed, Tengo stared at his father's hands. They were lined up neatly on his knees, right hand on right knee, left hand on left knee, stock still. Small, dark hands, they looked tanned to the core by long years of outdoor work. "My mother didn't really die of an illness when I was little, did she?" Tengo asked slowly, speaking phrase by phrase. His father did not answer. His expression did not change, and his hands did not move. His eyes focused on Tengo as if they were observing something unfamiliar. "My mother left you. She got rid of you and left me behind. She probably went off with another man. Am I wrong?" His father nodded. "It is not good to steal radio waves. You can't get away with it, doing anything you like." "This man understands my questions perfectly well. He just doesn't want to answer them directly," Tengo felt. "Father," Tengo addressed him, "you may not actually be my father, but I'll call you that for now because I don't know what else to call you. To tell you the truth, I've never liked you. Maybe I've even hated you most of the time. You know that, don't you? But even supposing you are not my real father, and there is no blood connection between us, I no longer have any reason to hate you. I don't know if I can go so far as to be fond of you, but I think that at least I should be able to understand you better than I do now. I've always wanted to know the truth about who I am and where I came from. That's all. But no one ever told me. If you will tell me the truth right now, I won't hate you or dislike you any more. In fact, I would welcome the opportunity not to have to hate you or dislike you any longer." His father went on staring at Tengo with expressionless eyes, saying nothing, but Tengo felt he might be seeing the tiniest gleam of light flashing somewhere deep within those empty swallows' nests. "I am nothing," Tengo said. "You are right. I'm like someone who's been thrown into the ocean at night, floating all alone. I reach out, but no one is there. I call out, but no one answers. I have no connection to anything. The closest thing I have to a family is you, but you hold on to the secret and won't even try to tell me anything. Meanwhile, in this seaside town, your memory goes through repeated ups and downs as it steadily deteriorates day by day. Like your memory, the truth about me is being lost. Without the aid of truth, I am nothing, and I can never be anything. You are right about that, too." "Knowledge is a precious social asset," his father said in a monotone, though his voice was somewhat quieter than before, as if someone behind him had reached over and turned down the volume. "It is an asset that must be amassed in abundant stockpiles and utilized with the utmost care. It must be handed down to the next generation in fruitful forms. For that reason, too, NHK needs to have all of your subscription fees and—" This is a kind of mantra for him, thought Tengo. He has protected himself all these years by reciting such phrases. Tengo felt he had to smash this obstinate amulet of his, to pull the living human being out from behind the surrounding barrier. He cut his father short. "What kind of person was my mother? Where did she go? What happened to her?" His father brought his incantation to a sudden halt. Tengo went on. "I'm tired of living in hatred and resentment. I'm tired of living unable to love anyone. I don't have a single friend. Not one. And worst of all, I can't even love myself. Why is that? Why can't I love myself? It's because I can't love anyone else. A person learns how to love himself through the simple acts of loving and being loved by someone else. Do you understand what I'm saying? A person who is incapable of loving another cannot properly love himself." "No, I'm not blaming you for this. Come to think of it, you may be such a victim. You probably don't know how to love yourself. Am I wrong about that?" His father was closed off in silence, lips shut tight. It was impossible to tell from his expression whether he had understood Tengo or not. Tengo also fell silent and settled more deeply into his chair. A breeze blew in through the open window, stirred the sun-bleached curtains and the delicate petals of the potted plant, and slipped through the open door into the corridor. The smell of the sea was stronger than before. The soft sound of pine needles brushing against each other blended with the cries of the cicadas. His voice softer now, Tengo went on. "A vision often comes to me, the same one over and over, ever since I can remember. I suspect it's probably not so much a vision as a memory of something that actually happened. I'm 1.5 years old, and my mother is next to me. She and a young man are holding each other. The man is not you. Who he is, I have no idea, but he is definitely not you. I don't know why, but the scene is permanently burned into me. His father said nothing, but his eyes were clearly seeing something else, something not there. The two maintained their silence. Tengo was listening to the suddenly stronger breeze. He did not know what his father was listening to.
"I wonder if I might ask you to read me something," his father said in formal tones after a long silence. "My sight has deteriorated to the point where I can't read books anymore. I can't follow the words on the page for long. That bookcase has some books. Choose any one you like."
Tengo gave up and left his chair to scan the spines of the volumes in the bookcase. Most of them were historical novels set in ancient times when samurai roamed the land. All the volumes of Sword of Doom were there. Tengo couldn't bring himself to read his father some musty old book full of archaic language.
"If you don't mind, I'd rather read a story about a town of cats," Tengo said. "I brought it to read myself."
"A story about a town of cats," his father said, savoring the words.
"Please read that to me, if it is not too much trouble."
Tengo looked at his watch.
"It's no trouble at all. I have plenty of time before my train leaves. It's an odd story. I don't know if you'll like it or not."
Tengo pulled out his paperback and started reading Town of Cats. His father listened to him read the entire story, not changing his position in the chair by the window. Tengo read slowly in a clearly audible voice, taking 2 or 3 breaks along the way to catch his breath. He glanced at his father whenever he stopped reading, but saw no discernible reaction on his face. Was he enjoying the story or not? He could not tell. When he was through reading the story, his father was sitting perfectly still with his eyes closed. He looked as if he could be sound asleep, but he was not. He was simply deep inside the story, and it took him a while to come back out. Tengo waited patiently for that to happen. The afternoon light had begun to weaken and blend with touches of evening. The ocean breeze continued to shake the pines.
"Does that town of cats have television?" his father asked.
"The story was written in Germany in the 1930s. They didn't have television yet back then. They did have radio, though."
"I was in Manchuria, but I didn't even have a radio. There weren't any stations. The newspaper often didn't arrive, and when it did, it was 2 weeks old. There was hardly anything to eat, and we had no women. Sometimes there were wolves roaming around. It was like the edge of the earth out there."
He fell silent for a while, thinking, probably recalling the hard life he led as a young pioneer in distant Manchuria. But those memories soon clouded over, swallowed up into nothingness. Tengo could read these movements of his father's mind from the changing expressions on his face.
"Did the cats build the town, or did people build it a long time ago, and the cats came to live there?"
his father asked, speaking toward the window pane as if to himself, though the question seemed to have been directed to Tengo.
"I don't know," Tengo said, "but it does seem to have been built by human beings long before. Maybe the people left for some reason. Say they all died in an epidemic, and the cats came to live there."
His father nodded.
"When a vacuum forms, something has to come along to fill it, because that's what everybody does."
"That's what everybody does."
"Exactly.
What kind of vacuum are you filling?" His father scowled. His long eyebrows came down to hide his eyes. Then he said, with a touch of sarcasm in his voice,
"Don't you know?"
"I don't know," Tengo said. His father's nostrils flared. One eyebrow rose slightly. This was the expression he always used when he was dissatisfied with something.
"If you can't understand it without an explanation, you can't understand it with an explanation."
Tengo narrowed his eyes, trying to read the man's expression. Never once had his father employed such odd, suggestive language. He always spoke in concrete, practical terms, to say only what was necessary when necessary. That was his unshakable definition of a conversation. But there was no expression on his face to be read.
"I see. So you are filling in some kind of vacuum," Tengo said. "All right, then. Who is going to fill the vacuum that you have left behind?"
"You,"
his father declared, raising an index finger and thrusting it straight at Tengo. Isn't it obvious? I have been filling in the vacuum that somebody else made, so you will fill in the vacuum that I have made. Like taking turns. The way the cats filled in the town after the people were gone. Right. Lost, like the town, his father said. Then he stared vacantly at his own outstretched index finger, as if looking at some mysterious, misplaced object. Lost like the town, Tengo repeated his father's words. The woman who gave birth to you is not anywhere anymore. Not anywhere. Lost like the town. Are you saying she's dead? His father made no reply to that. Tengo sighed. So then who is my father? Just a vacuum. Your mother joined her body with a vacuum and gave birth to you. I filled in that vacuum. Having said that much, his father closed his eyes and closed his mouth. Joined her body with a vacuum? Yes. And you raised me, is that what you're saying? After one ceremonious clearing of his throat, his father said, as if trying to explain a simple truth to a slow-witted child, That is why I said, if you can't understand it without an explanation, you can't understand it with an explanation. So you're telling me that I came out of a vacuum? Tengo asked. No answer. Tengo folded his hands in his lap and looked straight into his father's face once more. This man is no empty shell, no vacant house. He is a flesh-and-blood human being with a narrow, stubborn soul and shadowed memories, surviving in fits and starts on this patch of land by the sea. He has no choice but to coexist with the vacuum that is slowly spreading inside him. The vacuum and his memories are still at odds, but eventually, regardless of his wishes, the vacuum will completely swallow up whatever memories are left. It is just a matter of time. Could the vacuum that he is confronting now be the same vacuum from which I was born? Tengo thought he might be hearing the distant rumble of the sea mixed with the early evening breeze slipping through the pine branches, though it could have been an illusion.
Chapter 9 Almame What Comes as a Payment for Heavenly Grace. When Almame walked into the adjoining room, Buzzcut followed and swiftly closed the door. The room was totally dark. Thick curtains covered the window, and all lights had been extinguished. A few rays of light seeped in through a gap between the curtains, serving only to emphasize the darkness of everything else. It took time for her eyes to adjust to the darkness, as in a movie theater or planetarium. The first thing she saw was the display of an electric clock on a low table. Its green figures read 7:20 p.m. When a few more seconds passed, she could tell that there was a large bed against the back wall. The clock was near the head of the bed. This room was somewhat smaller than the spacious adjoining room, but it was still larger than an ordinary hotel room. On the bed was a deep black object, like a small mountain. Still more time had to go by before Almame could tell that its irregular outline indicated the presence of a human body. During this interval, the outline remained perfectly unbroken. She could detect no signs of life. There was no breathing to be heard. The only sound was a soft rush of air from the air conditioner near the ceiling. Still, the body was not dead. Buzzcut's actions were based on the premise that this was a living human being. This was a very large person, most likely a man. She could not be sure, but the person did not seem to be facing in this direction, and did not seem to be under the covers, but rather was lying face down on the made-up bed, like a large animal at the back of a cave, trying not to expend its physical energy while it allows its wounds to heal. It is time, Buzzcut announced in the direction of the shadow. There was a new tension in his voice. Whether or not the man heard Buzzcut's voice was unclear. The dark mound on the bed remained perfectly still. Buzzcut stood stiffly by the door, waiting. The room was enveloped in a silence so deep, Ah Mama could hear someone swallow, and then she realized that the sound of swallowing had come from her. Gripping her gym bag in her right hand, Ah Mama, like Buzzcut, was waiting for something to happen. The clock display changed to 7:21, then 7:22, then 7:23. Eventually, the outline on the bed began to show a slight degree of motion, a faint shudder that soon became a clear movement. The person must have been in a deep sleep or a state resembling sleep. The muscles awoke. The upper body began to rise, and, in time, the consciousness was regained. The shadow sat straight up on the bed, legs folded. "It's definitely a man," thought Ah Mama. "It is time," Buzzcut said again. Ah Mama heard the man release a long breath. It was like a heavy sigh slowly rising from the bottom of a deep well. Next came the sound of a large inhalation. It was as wild and unsettling as a gale tearing through a forest. Then the cycle started again. The two utterly different types of sound repeated, separated by a long silence. This made Ah Mama feel uneasy. She sensed that she had found her way into a region that was completely foreign to her. A deep ocean trench, say, or the surface of an unknown asteroid. The kind of place it might be possible to reach with great effort, but from which return was impossible. Her eyes refused to adapt fully to the darkness. She could now see to a certain point, but no farther. All that her eyes could reach was a man's dark silhouette. She could not tell which way he was facing or what he was looking at. All she could see was that he was an extremely large man and that his shoulders seemed to rise and fall quietly, but enormously, with each breath. This was not normal breathing. Rather, it was breathing that had a special purpose and function and that was performed with the entire body. She pictured the large movements of his shoulder blades and diaphragm expanding and contracting. No ordinary human being could breathe with such fierce intensity. It was a distinctive method of breathing that could only be mastered through long, intense training. Buzzcut stood next to her at full attention, back straight, chin in. His breathing was shallow and quick, in contrast to that of the man on the bed. He was trying to minimize his presence as he waited for the intense deep breathing sequence to end. Apparently, it was an activity the man practiced routinely. Like Buzzcut, Ah Mama could do nothing but wait for it to end. It was probably a process the man needed to go through to become fully awake. Finally, the special breathing ended in stages, the way a large machine stops running. The intervals between breaths grew gradually longer, concluding with one long breath that seemed to squeeze everything out. A deep silence fell over the room once again. "It is time," Buzzcut said a third time. The man's head moved slowly. He now seemed to be facing Buzzcut. "You may leave the room," the man said. His voice was a deep, clear baritone, decisive and unambiguous. His body had apparently attained complete wakefulness. Buzzcut gave one shallow bow in the darkness and left the room the way he had entered it, with no unnecessary movements. The door closed, leaving Ah Mama alone in the room with the man. "I'm sorry it's so dark," the man said, most likely to Ah Mama.
"I don't mind," Ah Mama said.
"We had to make it dark," the man said softly. "But don't worry. You will not be hurt."
Ah Mama nodded. Then, Recalling that she was in darkness, she said aloud, "I see." Her voice was somewhat harder and higher than normal. For a time, the man stared at Ah-Mama in the darkness. She felt herself being stared at intensely. His gaze was precise and attentive to detail. He was not so much looking at her as viewing her. He seemed able to survey each inch of her body. She felt as if he had, in an instant, stripped off every piece of clothing and left her stark naked. But his gaze didn't stop with the skin. It pierced through to her muscles and organs and uterus. "He can see in the dark," she thought. "He is viewing far more than the eyes can see." "Things can be seen better in the darkness," he said, as if he had just seen into her mind. "But the longer you spend in the dark, the harder it becomes to return to the world above ground where the light is. You have to call a stop to it at some point." Having said this, he spent another interval observing Ah-Mama. There was nothing sexual in his gaze. He was just viewing her as an object, the way a boat passenger stares at the shape of a passing island. But this was no ordinary passenger. He was trying to see through to everything about the island. With prolonged exposure to such a relentless, piercing gaze, Ah-Mama strongly felt the imperfections of her own fleshy self. This was not how she felt normally. Aside from the size of her breasts, she was, if anything, proud of her body. She trained it daily and kept it beautiful. Her muscles were smooth and taut, without the slightest excess flesh. Stared at by this man, however, she could not help but feel that her flesh was a worn-out old bag of meat. As though he had read her thoughts, the man stopped staring at her. She felt the power suddenly go out of his gaze. It was as if someone had been spraying water with a hose when another person behind the building turned off the spigot. "Sorry, but could you open the curtains just a bit?" the man asked softly. "I'm sure you could use some light, too, for your work." Setting the gym bag on the floor, Ah-Mama went over to the window and pulled on the cords at the side to open first the thick, heavy curtains and then the inner white lace curtains. Nighttime Tokyo poured its light into the room. Tokyo Tower's floodlights, the lamps lining the elevated expressway, the moving headlights of cars, the lighted windows of high-rise buildings, the colorful rooftop neon signs, they all combined to illuminate the hotel room with that mixed light unique to the big city. But just barely. Enough so that Ah-Mama was now able to make out some of the room's furnishings. Ah-Mama saw the light with a pang of familiarity. This was light from the world to which she herself belonged. She suddenly realized how urgently she needed such light. As weak as it was, though, it appeared to be too strong for the man's eyes. Still seated on the bed in the lotus position, he covered his face with his two large hands. "Are you all right?" Ah-Mama asked. "Don't worry," he said. "Shall I close the curtains a bit more?" "No, that's fine. I have a problem with my retinas. It takes time for them to adjust to light. I'll be all right in a minute. Have a seat over there." "A problem with his retinas?" Ah-Mama wondered. People with retinal problems are usually on the verge of going blind. But this was of no concern to Ah-Mama now. She was not here to deal with this man's sight. While the man was covering his face with his hands and letting his eyes adjust to the light streaming in from the window, Ah-Mama sat on a sofa and watched him. Now it was her turn to study him in detail. He was a very large man. Not fat, just large. Tall and broad and powerful looking. She had heard about his large size from the Dowager, but she had not expected him to be this big. There was, of course, no reason that a religious guru should not be huge. She imagined 10-year-old girls being raped by this big man and found herself scowling. She imagined him naked and mounted on a tiny girl. There was no way for such girls to resist. Even an adult woman would have a difficult time of it. The man was wearing something like thin sweatpants that narrowed at the ankles with elastic bands, and a solid-color, long-sleeved shirt that had a slight silk-like sheen. The loose-fitting shirt buttoned up the front, but the man had left the two top buttons open. Both the pants and the shirt appeared to be white or a light cream color. These were not pajamas, but more like comfortable lounging clothes or an outfit that would look normal under palm trees in southern lands. His bare feet looked big. The broad stone wall of his shoulders brought to mind an experienced martial arts combatant. After waiting for a pause in Ah Mama's observation, the man said, "Thanks for coming today." "It's my job," Ah Mama said in a voice devoid of emotion. "I go where I'm needed." Even as she spoke, however, she felt like a prostitute who had come when called. Perhaps this was due to the way he had undressed her in the darkness with that penetrating gaze. "How much do you know about me?" the man asked Al-Mama, his hand still covering his face. "How much do I know about you?" "That's right." "Almost nothing," Al-Mama said, choosing her words carefully. "I have not even been told your name. All I know is that you are the head of a religious organization in Nagano or Yamanashi, that you have some kind of physical problem, and that I may be able to help you with it." The man gave his head a few quick shakes and took his hands away from his face. Now he and Aomame were looking directly at each other. His hair was long. His abundant head of hair hung straight down to his shoulders. It had much gray mixed in. The man was probably somewhere in his late 40s or early 50s. He had a large nose that occupied a good deal of his face. It was admirably straight and brought to mind a calendar photo of the Alps. The mountain had a broad base and great dignity. It was the first thing one noticed when looking at his face, and it contrasted sharply with his eyes, which were set so deeply into his face that it was hard to tell what they were looking at. Like his body, his face was broad and thick. Clean-shaven, it bore no scars or moles. The features worked well together, producing a look of serenity and intelligence, but also something peculiar, out of the ordinary, something that did not inspire easy trust. It was the kind of face that, on first impression, gives people pause. Perhaps it was because the nose was too big. Because of it, the face was missing a certain balance. Perhaps the root of what left the observer feeling unsettled. Or perhaps it was the deep-set eyes that did it. The way they gave off that quiet glow of an ancient glacier. Then again, it might have been the cruel impression created by the thin lips, which looked as if they were ready to spit out unpredictable words at any moment.
"And besides that?" he asked.
"Besides that, I have heard very little. All I was told was to be prepared to perform stretching exercises. The muscles and joints are my area of expertise. I don't need to know much about my clients' positions or personalities." Just like a whore, Al-Mama thought.
"I understand what you are saying," the man said in a deep voice. "But in my case, you might need some explanation."
"I would be glad to listen to anything you might wish to share."
"People call me leader, but I almost never show my face to anyone. Most of our believers,
although they belong to the religion and live in the same compound, have no idea what I look like.
Al-Mamin nodded.
But here I am, letting you see my face. For one thing, I can hardly ask you to treat me in the dark or blindfolded. And there is also the question of courtesy.
What I do is not a treatment, Al-Mamin calmly corrected him. It is simply the stretching of the muscles. I am not licensed to perform medical procedures. All I do is force people to stretch the muscles they don't normally use, or the ones that are difficult to use. And that way, we prevent the deterioration of their physical strength. The man appeared to smile faintly, though it might have been a mere illusion caused by a slight twitching of his facial muscles.
I am quite aware of that. I simply used the word treat for convenience's sake. Don't worry. All I was trying to say was that you are now seeing something that most people are not able to see, and I wanted you to be aware of that.
I was warned in there not to say anything about this to anyone, Al-Mamin said, pointing toward the door to the adjoining room. But none of you need to worry. Nothing that I observe here will find its way outside. I touch many people's bodies in my work. You may be someone in a special position, but to me, you are merely one of many people with muscle problems. The only part of you that concerns me is your muscles.
I hear you were a Society of Witnesses believer as a child.
It's not as if I chose to become a believer. I was simply raised that way. There is a big difference between the two.
Indeed. A very big difference, the man said. But people can never fully divorce themselves from the images implanted during early childhood.
For better or worse, Al-Mamin said.
The witnesses' doctrines are very different from those of the religion that I belong to. If you ask me, any religion that takes the end of the world as one of its central tenets is more or less bogus. In my view, the only thing that ever ends is the individual. That said, the Society of Witnesses is an amazingly tough religion. Its history is not very long, but it has withstood many tests and has steadily continued to increase the number of its believers. There is a lot that can be learned from that.
It probably just shows how close-minded they've been. The smaller and narrower such a group is, the more firmly they can resist outside pressure.
You are probably right about that, the man said, pausing for a few moments. In any case, we're not here to discuss religion.
Al-Mamin said nothing.
What I want you to understand is the fact that my body has many special things about it.
Al-Mamin, still seated, waited for him to go on.
As I said before, my eyes can't stand strong light. This symptom appeared some years ago. I had no particular problem until that time, but all at once, at some point, it started. This was the main reason I stopped coming into people's presence. I spend practically all my time in dark rooms.
I'm afraid I can't do anything for vision problems, Al-Mamin said. As I said before, the muscles are my area of expertise.
Yes, I'm quite aware of that. And of course I consulted medical specialists. I have been to any number of famous eye doctors and had many tests. But they tell me there is nothing they can do at this point. My retinas have been damaged, but they don't know the cause. The symptoms are slowly progressing. If things go on like this, I will lose my sight before long. As you say, of course, this is a problem that has nothing to do with the muscles. But let me list my physical problems in order, and when I am through, we can think about what you can and cannot do.
Al-Mame nodded.
The next problem is that my muscles often go stiff, the man said. I quite literally can't move a muscle. They become rock hard and stay that way for hours. All I can do at such times is lie down. I don't feel any pain. All the muscles of my body simply become immobile. I can't even move a finger. The only thing I can manage to move, through sheer willpower, is my eyeballs. This happens once or twice a month.
Do you have any sign beforehand that it is about to happen?
First, I have spasms. My muscles start twitching all over. That goes on for 10 to 20 minutes. After that, my muscles go dead, as if someone has turned off a switch. During those 10 or 20 minutes after the warning comes, I go to a place where I can stretch out, and I lie down. Like a boat seeking shelter from a storm in a cove, I wait there in hiding for the paralysis to pass over me. And though the paralysis is complete when it comes, my mind remains fully awake. No, if anything, it is awake with a special clarity.
You say you have no pain.
I lose all sensation. If you jabbed me with the needle, I wouldn't feel it.
Have you consulted a doctor about that?
I have been to all the best hospitals and any number of doctors. But all they can tell me is that this is an unprecedented affliction for which current medical knowledge can do nothing. I have tried traditional Chinese remedies, osteopathic physicians, acupuncture, moxibustion, massage, hot spring cures, everything I could think of, but have had no results worth talking about.
Al-Mame frowned slightly. All my approach does is to stimulate the normal bodily functions. I doubt that it will have much effect on such severe problems.
Yes, I am quite aware of that as well. But I am trying to exhaust every possibility. Even if your method has no effect, that is not your responsibility. Just do to me what you always do. I would like to see how my body responds to it.
Al-Mame pictured the man's huge body lying motionless in some dark place, like a hibernating animal. When was the last time you experienced the paralysis?
10 days ago, the man said. And, this is a bit difficult to bring up, but there is one more thing I should probably mention.
Feel free to tell me anything.
All the time my muscles are in that state of suspended animation, I have an erection.
Al-Mame's frown deepened. You mean to say that your sex organ remains hard for hours at a time?
That is correct.
But you have no feeling?
None at all, he said. No sexual desire either. I just harden up, like a rock the way my muscles do.
Al-Mame gave her head a little shake and did her best to resume a normal expression.
I don't believe I can do anything about that either. It's quite far from my area of expertise. This is difficult for me to talk about, and you probably don't want to hear about it either. But may I tell you a bit more?
Please do. Your secrets are safe with me.
During this interval, it happens that I am physically joined with girls.
Girls?
I have a number of females around me. Whenever I go into my paralytic state, they take turns mounting me and having sexual relations with me. I have no feeling at all. I feel no sexual pleasure, but I do ejaculate with each of them.
Al-Mame kept silent. He continued,
altogether, there are 3 girls, all in their teens. I am sure you must be wondering why I have such young girls around me, and why they must have sex with me. Could it be, perhaps, part of a religious practice? Still sitting cross-legged on the bed, the man took a deep breath. It is thought that these paralyses of mine are a form of grace bestowed by heaven, a kind of sacred state. Thus, when I am visited by those states, the girls come to me and join their bodies with mine. They are trying to become impregnated with my heir. Al-Mame looked at him, saying nothing. He also fell silent. So, then what you are telling me is that the girl's purpose is to become pregnant? To carry your child? Al-Mame then asked. That is correct. And during this several-hour period while you lie there paralyzed, you have three ejaculations with these three girls? That is correct. Al-Mame could not help but realize that she had gotten herself into a terribly complicated situation. She was about to murder this man, to send him to the other side. Yet here she was being given the strange secrets of his flesh. I don't quite understand the precise nature of your problem. All the muscles of your body become paralyzed once or twice a month. When that happens, your three girlfriends come and have sex with you. True, that is not exactly normal in common sense terms, but they are not my girlfriends, the man said, cutting her short. They serve me as shrine maidens. Joining their bodies with mine is one of their duties. Duties? It is a role that has been assigned to them, to become pregnant with my heir. Assigned by whom? Al-Mame asked. That would be a long story, the man said. The problem is that all of this is steadily leading toward the destruction of my flesh. So then, have they gotten pregnant? No, not yet. And there is little possibility that any of them will. They have not started their periods. Still, they are hoping for a miracle through heavenly grace. None of them have gotten pregnant. They are not menstruating, Al-Mame said. And your flesh is headed for destruction. Little by little, the time of each paralytic episode is growing longer. And the episodes are increasing in number. They started 7 years ago. Back then, I would have one episode in 2 or 3 months. Now it is once or twice a month, and after each paralysis ends, my body is racked by excruciating pain and exhaustion. I have to live this way for a week or more each time. I feel as if my whole body is being stabbed by thick needles. I have intense headaches and an overwhelming fatigue. I find it impossible to sleep, and no medicine has done anything to alleviate the pain. The man sighed. Then he continued, "The second week after the episode is better than the first, but still the pain never entirely goes away. Intense pain comes over me like a wave several times a day. I can hardly breathe. My organs don't function properly. My joints creak like a machine that needs oiling. My flesh is being devoured and my blood sucked out. I can feel it happening. But what is gnawing away at me is neither cancer nor a parasite. I have had every test they can think of, but they can never find the cause. They tell me I'm the picture of health. Medical science cannot explain my torment. The only conclusion is that this is the price I must pay for the heavenly grace I experience." This man is surely on the road to destruction, Al-Mame thought. But she could find no hint of emaciation about him. He seemed sturdily built in every way, and appeared to have the discipline to withstand intense pain. And yet she could sense that his flesh was headed for destruction. This man is diseased. I don't know what his disease might be, but even if I don't take steps to dispatch him right now, he will suffer intense pain as his flesh is slowly destroyed, and he encounters inevitable death.
I can't stop its progress, the man said, as if he had read Amame's thoughts. Every part of me is being eaten away, my body hollowed out, and a horribly painful death awaits me. They'll just throw me away like a useless old car.
They? Amame asked. Who are they?
I am talking about the ones who are eating away at my flesh like this, the man said. But never mind that. What I am looking for now is some way to have my very real pain eased to some extent. That is what I need more than anything, even if the solution is not complete. This pain is unbearable. At times, at certain times, the pain deepens dramatically, as if it has a direct link to the center of the earth. It is a kind of pain that no one else besides me can grasp. It has robbed me of many things, but in return it has given me much. Deep special pain bestows deep special grace. Not that the grace alleviates the pain, of course, nor can it prevent the coming destruction.
A deep silence followed for some moments. Amame finally managed to speak. I know I keep saying the same thing, but I can't help thinking that the techniques at my disposal can do almost nothing for your problem, especially if it is something that has come to you as a payment for heavenly grace. Leader sat up straight and looked at Amame with those small, deep-set glacier-like eyes. Then he opened his long, thin lips.
No. I think you can do something for me. Something that only you can do.
I hope you're right.
I am right. I know it, the man said. I know a lot of things. If you are willing, I would like to have you start now. Do what you always do.
I'll try, Amame said, her voice tense and hollow. What I always do, Amame thought.
Chapter 10. Tengo. You have declined our offer. Tengo said goodbye to his father just before 6 p.m. While he waited for the taxi to come, the two of them sat across from each other by the window, saying nothing. Tengo indulged in his own unhurried thoughts while his father stared hard at the view outside the window, frowning. The sun had dropped down, and the sky's pale blue was slowly deepening. He had many more questions he wanted to ask, but he knew that there would be no answers coming back. The sight of his father's tightly clenched lips told him that. His father had obviously decided to say nothing more, so Tengo decided not to ask any more. If you couldn't understand something without an explanation, you couldn't understand it with an explanation, as his father had said. When the time for him to leave drew near, Tengo said, "You told me a lot today. It was indirect and often hard to grasp, but it was probably as honest and open as you could make it." Tengo looked at his father, but there was no change of expression. "I still have some things I'd like to ask you, but I know they would only cause you pain. All I can do is guess the rest from what you've told me. You are probably not my father by blood. That is what I assume. I don't know the details, but I have to think that in general. If I'm wrong, please tell me so." His father made no reply. Tengo continued, "If my assumption is correct, that makes it easier for me. Not because I hate you, but, as I said before, because I no longer need to hate you. You seem to have raised me as your son, even though we had no blood ties. I should be grateful for that. Unfortunately, we were never very good at being father and son, but that's another problem. Still, his